Discerning Hearts presents The Ascent of Mount Carmel by St. John of the Cross. Translated by David Lewis and read by Ed Humble. Book 2, Chapter 23, which begins to treat of the apprehensions of the understanding that come in a purely spiritual way and describes their nature.
I have been somewhat concise in the discussion of those intellectual apprehensions which are derived from the senses, if we regard the abundance of the matter, and I am unwilling to pursue it at greater length, because, so far as my purpose is concerned, which is the extrication of the intellect from them, and the direction of it into the night of faith, I think I have said more than enough. I shall now, therefore, enter on the discussion of the other four apprehensions of the intellect, which, in the 10th chapter, I said were purely spiritual, namely, visions, revelations, locutions, and spiritual impressions. I call these purely spiritual, because they do not reach the intellect, like those which are corporeal and imaginary, by the way of the senses of the body, but because they reach it independently of every bodily sense, interior or exterior, clearly and distinctly in a supernatural way, and passively, that is, irrespectively of, at least, any active operation on the part of the soul itself. Speaking generally, we may say that these four apprehensions may be called visions of the soul, for we say that the soul sees when it understands. And inasmuch as all these apprehensions are intelligible to the intellect, we say they are spiritually visible, and therefore the particular intelligence of them, formed in the intellect, may be called intellectual vision. And as all the objects of the senses, of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, in so far as they are true or false, are objects of the intellect, it follows that, as all that is bodily visible is an occasion of corporeal visions to the bodily eyes, so all that is intelligible is an occasion of spiritual vision to the spiritual eye of the soul, which is the intellect. For as I have said, to understand is to see. And thus, speaking generally, these four apprehensions may be called visions. The other senses, however, cannot be thus applied, for not one of them is capable of receiving, as such, the subject matter of another. But as these apprehensions are represented to the soul in the same manner as to all the senses, it follows, to use the proper and specific terms, that all which the intellect receives by way of seeing, for it can see spiritually, as the eyes see bodily, may be called vision. That which it receives by apprehending and perceiving new things, revelation. That which it receives by way of hearing, locution, and that which it receives by way of the other senses, such as spiritual odor, taste, or delectation, of which the soul is supernaturally conscious, may be called spiritual impressions. From all this the intellect elicits an active intelligence, or spiritual vision, as I have said, without perceiving any form, image, or figure whatever of the natural imagination or fancy, which could furnish any foundation for it. For these things are communicated directly to the soul by a supernatural operation and by supernatural means. The intellect, therefore, must be extricated from these things also, precisely as from the corporeal and imaginary apprehensions, by being guided and directed into the spiritual night of faith, to the divine and substantial union of the love of God. For if this be not effected, the intellect will soon be perplexed and rude, and that solitude and detachment from them, which is requisite for travelling on the way of union, will be prevented. For, admitting that these apprehensions are more exalted, more profitable and safe, than those which are corporeal and imaginary, inasmuch as they are interior, purely spiritual, and less liable to the intrusions of Satan, because they are communications of God to the soul, in the greatest pureness and subtlety, independent of, at least, any active operations of the soul or of the imagination, still the intellect may be not only embarrassed by them, but by its incautiousness, greatly deluded. I might now finish with these four apprehensions together, by giving advice common to them all, as I have already done with the others, namely, let no man seek them or desire them. Still, inasmuch as a different course will enlighten us how to do so, and as there is something still to be said with reference to them, I think it well to treat of each one of them in particular. With this view, I now proceed to speak of the first of them, spiritual or intellectual visions.
Book 2, Chapter 24, which treats of two kinds of spiritual vision that come supernaturally.
I say then, speaking directly of the spiritual visions, independent of any bodily sense, that there are two kinds to which the intellect is liable, one of corporeal substances, another of abstract or incorporeal substances. The corporeal visions are visions of all material things in heaven and earth, visible to the soul in a certain light emanating from God, in which distant things of heaven and earth may be seen. The other visions of incorporeal things require a higher light. Thus, visions of incorporeal substances, as of angels and of souls, are not frequent or natural in this life, and still less so is the vision of the divine essence, which is peculiar to the blessed, unless it be communicated transiently by a dispensation of God, or by conservation of our natural life and condition, and the abstraction of the Spirit, as was perhaps the case of St. Paul, when he heard the unutterable secrets of the third heaven. Whether in the body, saith he, I know not, or out of the body, I know not. God knoweth. It is clear from the words of the apostle that he was carried out of himself by the act of God as to his natural existence. It is also believed that God showed his own essence to Moses, for he said unto him that he would set him in a hole of the rock, and protect him with his right hand, that he might not die when his glory passed by. This passing by was a transient vision, God upholding with his right hand the natural life of Moses. But these essential visions, such as those of St. Paul, Moses, and our father Elias, when, at the whistling of a gentle air, he covered his face with his mantle, are transient and of most rare occurrence, and scarcely ever granted, and to very few. For God shows them only to those who, like these, are the mighty ones of his church and law. Now, though, in the ordinary course, these visions cannot be clearly and distinctly seen in this life, the effect of them may be felt in the very substance of the soul, through the instrumentality of a loving knowledge, in the most sweet touch and union pertaining to the spiritual impressions, of which, by the grace of God, I shall speak hereafter. The end I have in view is the divine embracing, the union of the soul with the divine substance. I shall speak of it when I treat of the mystical, confused, or obscure intelligence, and explain how, in this loving and obscure knowledge, God unites himself with the soul, eminently and divinely. For this loving, obscure knowledge, which is faith, serves, in a manner, in this life as means of the divine union, as the light of glory hereafter serves for the beatific vision. Let me now then speak of visions or corporeal substances, spiritually presented to the soul, after the manner of bodily visions. as the eyes behold bodily things in natural light, so the intellect, in light supernaturally derived, beholds interiorly the same natural things, and others also such as God wills. The vision, however, is different in kind and form, for spiritual or intellectual visions are much more clear and subtle than bodily visions. When God grants this favor to anyone, he communicates to him that supernatural light wherein he beholds what God wills, most easily and most distinctly, whether they be things of heaven or of earth. Neither is their presence or absence any impediment to the vision. When these visions occur, it is as if a door were opened into a most marvelous light, whereby the soul sees, as men do when the lightning suddenly flashes in a dark night. The lightning makes surrounding objects visible for an instant, and then leaves them in obscurity, though the forms of them remain in the fancy. But in the case of the soul, the vision is much more perfect. For those things it saw in spirit in that light are so impressed upon it, that whenever God enlightens it again, it beholds them as distinctly as it did at first, precisely as in a mirror, in which we see objects reflected whenever we look upon it. These visions, once granted to the soul, never again leave it altogether, for the forms remain, though they become somewhat indistinct in the course of time. The effects of these visions in the soul are quietness, enlightenment, joy like glory, sweetness, pureness, love, humility, inclination or elevation of the mind to God, sometimes more, sometimes less, sometimes more of one, sometimes more of another, according to the disposition of the soul and the will of God. The devil, too, can produce or mimic these visions by means of a certain natural light. He employs therein the fancy in which, by spiritual insinuations, he presents clearly before the mind either present or distant things. And some doctors, commenting on the place in the Gospel where it is written that the devil showed our Lord all the kingdoms of the world, say that he did so by a spiritual insinuation, because it was impossible to see at once all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them with the bodily eyes. But there is a great difference between the visions of God and those of the evil one, for the effect of the latter is not like that of the former. Those of Satan result in dryness of spirit, in a tendency to self-esteem, to accept and make much of visions, and in no degree whatever do they produce the gentleness of humility and love of God. Again, the forms of the diabolic visions do not remain impressed on the soul with the sweet clearness of the others, neither do they endure, yea, rather are immediately effaced, unless it be when the soul attaches itself to them. In that case, the importance attached to them causes them to be remembered naturally, but with great dryness of spirit, and without the fruit of humility and love, which issue out of the good visions whenever they recur to the memory. These visions, inasmuch as they are visions of created things, between which and God there is no congruity or proportion, cannot subserve the intellect as proximate means of the divine union. It is, therefore, necessary for the soul to be negatively disposed with respect to them, as well as to the others, if it is to advance by the proximate means, which is faith. And therefore the forms which these visions show, and which remain impressed upon the soul, must not be treasured up nor preserved, neither must we trust to them, for this would be to embarrass ourselves by dwelling on forms, images, and persons, which relate to the interior life, and not to advance in the denial of all things onwards unto God. For supposing that these forms are continually present, that would be no great hindrance, if we make no account of them. Though it be true that a recollection of them excites the soul to a certain love of God and to contemplation, yet pure faith and detachment in darkness excites it much more, without the soul's knowing how or whence it cometh. The end of this will be that the soul goes forward, on fire with the anxieties of the most pure love of God, without knowing whence they come, or on what foundations they rest. In short, as faith is rooted and infused more and more into the soul, in this emptiness and darkness, in detachment from all things, in poverty of spirit, these are different expressions of one and the same thing, as also the charity of God is the more rooted and infused into the soul. And therefore, the more the soul strives to become blind and annihilated as to all interior and exterior things, the more it will be filled with faith and love and hope. But this love, at times, is neither comprehended nor felt, because it does not establish itself in the senses with tenderness, but in the soul with fortitude, with greater courage and resolution than before, though it sometimes overflows into the senses and shows itself tender and gentle. In order, then, to attain to this love, joy, and delight which visions affect, it is necessary that the soul should have fortitude and be mortified, so as to abide willingly in emptiness and darkness, and to lay the foundation of its love and delight on what it neither sees nor feels, on what it cannot see nor feel, namely, on God incomprehensible and supreme. Our way to Him is therefore of necessity in self-denial. Even if a soul were so wise, strong, and humble that the devil could not delude it by visions, nor make it presumptuous, as he generally does, it will make no progress, because it puts obstacles in the way of spiritual detachment and poverty of spirit, and emptiness in faith, the essential conditions of the divine union. As the principles established in the 19th and the 20th chapters, concerning the visions and supernatural apprehensions of the senses, are applicable to these visions also, I shall not spend further time now in treating of them at greater length.
Book 2, Chapter 25, which treats of revelations, describing their nature, and making a distinction between them.
I have now to speak, in the order laid down, of the spiritual apprehensions, which I have called revelations. Of these, some properly belong to the spirit of prophecy. In the first place, a revelation is nothing else but the disclosure of some hidden truth, or the manifestation of some secret or mystery. For instance, God permits a certain soul to understand a particular matter, declaring the truth of it to the intellect, or makes known certain things that he hath done, is doing, or intends to do. This being so, we may say that there are two kinds of revelations. One, the disclosure of truths to the intellect, properly called intellectual knowledge or intelligence. The other, a manifestation of secrets, and this is called revelation, with more propriety than the former. The first kind, strictly speaking, cannot be called revelation, because it consists in God's making the soul to understand pure truths, regarding not only temporal but also spiritual things, showing them openly and distinctly. I have resolved to treat of them under the term revelations, first, because of their mutual connection and proximity, and secondly, because I would not multiply distinctions. I distinguish revelations, therefore, from two kinds of apprehensions, intellectual knowledge and the manifestation of the secrets and hidden mysteries of God. I shall conclude the subject with the utmost brevity in two chapters, and, first, of intellectual knowledge.